Okay, we're back. And I want to return to something that I said at the very start of the presentation when I defined what a family is. That we have varying levels of legitimation for family forms. And this has changed over time. We have, I think, more or less collectively agreed that a cohabiting heterosexual couple can be a legitimate family. They can even, well, they can give birth to children. They can adopt children. They can legally share property and so on. There are some things they can't do. They cannot be the legal next of kin, and that has implications for issues related to health care and end of life. They can be the legal next of kin for their children, as it were. But it is still illegitimate in, I don't know, what's 50 minus 17? 33 states? For same-sex couples to have the same rights and responsibilities, to have the benefit of marriage that we know strengthens monogamy, if they happen to be two men or two women who simply want what any loving couple wants, to be in a safe place, in a safe country, where they are socially and morally supported. The state of Texas outlawed this twice. The legislature of Texas put forward a constitutional amendment a few years ago to ban same-sex marriage, to define by law marriage as an event or an act between one man and one woman. It was a constitutional amendment in a state which already had no way for a same-sex couple to legally be married. They couldn't get a marriage license. So we sort of doubled down in the state of Texas on this one until just fairly recently when a federal judge has set that aside, and we'll see what happens next. And there's been a groundswell in the last, I would say, 3 to 5 years, to the point where now 17 states in the District of Columbia have legalized same-sex marriage. There's a trend here that I think, unfortunately, the church is on the wrong side of. So that sort of tips where I'm going with this. You know, we have discussed the nature of group dynamics. And as a sociologist, I would say that it's like shooting fish in a barrel to say from a conflict point of view that the prohibition of same-sex marriage violates the rights of a minority group, right? Easy to do. And people make that claim all the time. But I want to walk over to the right wing here for a minute and at least point out that from a structural functionalist point of view, we need marriage to strengthen an inherently unstable group. And why should we withhold it if we're bootlicking Durkheimian functionalists, trying to create social solidarity? Why should we withhold it from people just because they happen to be of the same sex? Good question. I think, had we done that, had this been in place in the U.S., and routinely ratified and recognized for as long as, let's say we implemented the reality of same-sex marriage about the time we ended prohibition in the 20s. I think by the time the HIV virus hit the U.S. in 1980, the segment of our culture where that was most prolific and most widely spread, that among men who have sex with men, I think, and there's no way to prove it, this is just a theory on my part, I think the incidence of HIV would have been less pronounced because HIV transmitted among the group of men who have sex with men was largely transmitted through men who have sex with lots of other men. Absent the social support mechanism that makes that connection between, or that extension of eye contact, if you will, more likely, just wasn't there. And it wouldn't have eradicated it. Don't miss the point. I think with that social support structure that we call marriage, had that been available to men who simply were doing with other men what men and women always have done, even in loving and committed ways, I think the HIV incidents would have been less. I can't prove that. So as a sociologist, one who also happens to be a clergyman, I've made a personal decision about what I might do if I was asked a particular question. From both a conflict perspective and from a functionalist perspective. If anyone ever said to me, "Hey, Doc, hey, Rev, would you preside at our wedding?" I would say yes. I would say I would be honored to do so, especially if you want to fly me to Massachusetts and put my wife and I up for a weekend on Martha's Vineyard. That'd be great. I have done weddings for men and women where they have done similar type things. Spent a glorious weekend in San Diego one time on somebody else's nickel. Because this is great. This is what we need. We will do this, as it were. I would do it. I would be honored to do it. I've said that at presbytery meetings where there is not, there's a small but not insignificant risk to my credentials and career as a minister if I were to do that and make a big thing of it. And I wouldn't. I wouldn't make a big thing of it. I would simply say, let's do this. And if some ecclesiastical authority wants to say, "Hey, Rev, Doc, we caught you in the act of public prayer celebrating love. You're done." I'm going to go, "Okay, fine, have at it." And yet, there is this matter of the Bible. Even in the Bible Belt in the state of Texas, while we don't permit same-sex marriage, we do permit two men and two women to legally adopt a child, raise that child as the child of two parents. They can even work the arrangements with surrogates. Two women, one of them can in fact give birth. And sperm donation and surrogacy and all of that kind of stuff, in vitro fertilization, has enabled same-sex couples to be parents. And if successful parenthood, and this is a theory, is rooted on a stable parental environment, why would we allow two parents who can't get married legally to legally raise children? There's a disconnect there, in my view. Now I'll get to the part about the Bible. I just noticed a paragraph in here about that, so let's get to that. The most famous passage that people use as a biblical warrant to prohibit this is from Leviticus 18:22. And there's a transcript that more or less follows what I'm saying here, and it's posted on the web, and it'll give you Bible verses and all that that relate to this. "That homosexuality is an abomination unto the Lord," in Leviticus. Okay, fair enough. I personally do not think that what's abominable to the Lord is a monogamous loving couple. I think what's abominable to the Lord is rape, pillage, and plunder after warfare. That's in part what that was. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed not because of homosexuality, but because the people there were inhospitable to strangers. I think that's sort of interesting. Anyway, homosexuality is an abomination unto the Lord. You might be interested in that same part of the Bible, if this is part of what guides and governs your life. Watch out, because eating shellfish is also an abomination. If you were planning on fasting for Lent on Friday by eating shrimp, watch out. Might as well marry a girl if you're a girl. Selling one's daughter into slavery is fairly common, Exodus 21:7. Working on the Sabbath is punishable by death. Oh man, I get paid to preach. I hate that part. On Sunday. Rebellious sons who are gluttons and drunks are to be killed. So much for interfraternity council. Rape victims. This one's not so funny. Deuteronomy 22:23. Rape victims are punishable by death if they don't cry for help. And we still live in a world where sexual assault is among the most unreported of crimes. Although it turns out, five verses later, a man who rapes a virgin can settle the consequences of that with her dad for cash. Of course, that doesn't change the fact that that woman is now tainted, if you will, in her culture. I think that laws and rules of this type, they must have made sense in a far distant part of the world. And if you want to deal with that and go into it a little bit more, study biblical anthropology and archaeology. These are rules that regulated kinship and structure and all that kind of stuff. And they probably did make sense in that time. But nobody would lift out the shellfish one or the glutton and drunk one and say we just can't do that, or if you do it, you're going to hell. I've got another 7 minutes. Bear with me. In the same way that we do for folks who simply want to love each other in a committed relationship. Okay, that's the Old Testament. What would Jesus do? What would Jesus say? Interestingly enough, oddly enough, annoyingly enough in the minds of many, Jesus never mentions it, not once. So we have to sort of say, well, what would Jesus do? Well, what does he do with other types of people that are suspect in morality? Maybe even sexually suspect. It's a continuing theme in the New Testament as I read it, that Jesus is notoriously soft on sexual sinners. The woman caught in adultery. The woman at the well who's had five husbands, etc., etc., etc. You know who he reserves his harshest criticism for? The religious elite who make these rules. I think that's interesting. And yet there are passages in the New Testament, typically in the writings of the Apostle Paul and others writing under his name. There are three of them particularly, and I give you the chapter and verse in the text. 1 Corinthians 6, 1 Timothy 1. Both of those two use Greek words that are often most translated to mean sodomite or pedophile in terms of what in 1 Corinthians, apparently the Apostle Paul and whoever wrote 1 Timothy is talking about. Those are far distant concepts from the experience of committed couples. There's one passage in Romans 1, and this is attributed to the Apostle Paul. It's seemingly authentic. It says this, and I'll just read it and then talk about it for just a second. Romans 1:26. For this reason, God gave them up to degrading passions. Their women exchanged natural intercourse for unnatural, in the same way also the men, giving up natural intercourse with women, were consumed with passion for one another. Men committed shameless acts with men, etc. I think the operative phrase there is consuming passion. That is, when one thing becomes your only thing. It doesn't matter what that thing is. It's unhealthy. And in Paul's view, apparently, against the will of the Savior. I don't think that that one either says anything to or about two people who simply wish to be in love, to have that love ratified by their world, and to otherwise be left alone. I think it's important to remember that the writers of the New Testament epistles, apart from the Gospels, seem to speak much more directly against the leadership of women in the church. And I think since we've played fast and loose with that and interpreted it in light of recent developments in the role of women in culture, I think we need to do the same. We need to interpret everything in the New Testament or Old Testament in light of recent developments in life and culture, because life and culture was far different. Now, we can keep the basic idea. Love one another as you wish to be loved. Take care of the widows and orphans. Watch the heck out for the priests and the rabbis. I think that's good advice. So it baffles me a little bit why we lift passages out of both the Old and the New Testament and hit people over the head with them. Now, this is just one who's spent a lot of time both studying what the Bible is, what it means, and what its consequences are for 30 years plus in public ministry. There are a lot of things that we can argue about what that's about. But what I am certain of, I am certain of this, as certain as I am of anything else I know, that the intent of any sacred text, whether it be the Bible, the Quran, or anything else, the one thing it was never intended to be was a weapon. A while back, I actually put the title of this is my last deal here. I actually put the title of this sermon in the bulletin because I wanted people to remember it. I came up with the idea early in the week and put it in the bulletin so when people sat down, they saw. The title of today's sermon, Lunch with Jesus. The point of that sermon was, imagine for a second, and I would invite you to do that too. Imagine for a second that you had 30 minutes, and if this would be something you would welcome, if Jesus is important to you, or even if not, maybe you want to yell at him for a while, or maybe suggest that he was wrong about a lot of things, if he even existed at all. That's okay. But you get 30 minutes to have lunch with Jesus. And during that 30 minutes, he has granted you, in the same way that mythology grants wishes, you get to fix one social problem. You can actually say, this is what I think is most important, and you have to fix it, and Jesus will say, okay, I'll do that. You get one wish. In light of partisan politics, infant mortality, the waging of war on religious grounds, I mean, all of those things are just what the news leads with pretty much every day. Are you seriously going to try to convince Jesus at lunch that homosexuality, same-sex marriage, the leadership of gays in churches, is that going to be the one issue you want him to fix more than any other? Wouldn't be mine. What I have said for the last 15 or so minutes is not something that most people agree with, at least in Texas and maybe among the student body at Texas Tech. That's fine with me. The only point in doing what I just did was to tell you how someone who has studied this issue and many others from a variety of perspectives thinks it through and comes to a conclusion. Your job as a college student is to look at something that is controversial, something you wonder about, maybe something that annoys you, and learn how to think it through, examine it from all sides, and come to a conclusion. I just modeled for you how to do that. I expect that most of you won't agree with me, and that's perfectly fine with me. If you'd like to continue this discussion in person or on email or in any other way, the transcript of this is on the web, the audio recording is on the web, show it to your parents, your ministers, whoever else in your life. I am open to and welcome any more conversation about this. And most of all, I very much appreciate your attention. Thank you.